Welcome to the I-29 Moo U Dairy Podcast. The I-29 Moo University is a consortium of the land-grant universities located in Minnesota, Iowa, South Dakota, and Nebraska. This podcast covers timely news, information, and research for today's dairy industry.
Hi, my name is Jim Sulfer. I'm with the University of Minnesota Extension Service as kind of a regional dairy educator. And I have my colleague with me today, Mr. Fred Hall from Northwest Iowa. Welcome, Fred.
Well, thank you, Jim. I tell you, this Beef on Dairy Dialogue podcast has really taken off. I'm really excited that we have the opportunity to talk with these folks leading the industry. And today we get the opportunity to visit with Melanie.
Yeah, you're right, Fred. It's just been really interesting how this whole industry and beef on dairy has changed over the last probably decade or so. And you're right. Today, our guest today is Melanie. I won't get your name right, so I'll let you pronounce the rest of your name. She is a PhD candidate at Michigan State University.
Student. I'll take my exams in December.
Okay. Well, I don't understand all the technology or all the terminology, but Melanie presented this year at our I-29 Moo University Dairy Beef Short Course that was held during the Central Plains Dairy Expo, and she's graciously agreed to join us here and talk about information related to corn silage inclusion rate on our beef on dairy cattle in the feed yard. Well, welcome, Melanie. I'll let you kind of finish your introduction of yourself a little bit before we get started.
Yeah, thank you for having me. My name is Melanie Pimentel Concepcion. I'm from Puerto Rico originally, and I moved to Michigan a few years ago to work on my master's with Dr. Dan Buskirk here at Michigan State. And we started with beef on dairy, so all my work has been on beef on dairy. It was around 2021, which is when researchers started to look more into this production system. And we developed a study where we compared beef on dairy to dairy steers in the feedlot. We just wanted to look at performance, carcass traits, and economics because we wanted to understand what the break-even would be, how much we should be paying for them, because at the time we were seeing a really big disconnect in the market. People were paying too much for these crosses, but they didn't know if that was what it should be or not compared to the Holsteins and the beef. So we worked on that study. And during that time, other studies came out and started noticing that there were liver abscess issues or high incidences of liver abscesses in beef on dairy cattle. And that's where we developed this second study where we decided to look at if we fed different levels of corn silage in the diet, so different levels of fiber in the finishing diet of beef on dairy and dairy steer, and do something similar where we would compare growth, carcass traits, and economics, but also see how the liver abscess incidence would look based on these different diets and if we would even see liver abscesses in these beef on dairy cattle. So that's kind of how that study came to be.
So let's start with your first study. Give me your primary take-home message from that one.
So in our first study, we compared these beef on Holstein steers to Holstein steers, and we saw that they had faster growth rates. So they tended to have greater alveolar gains. They were heavier on the carcass side. They had more muscling. So we saw improved yield grades. We saw bigger ribeye areas compared to the Holsteins. They had a more brown shape, which is what we'd expect from beef type cattle compared to dairy that have more angular ribeyes. And we also saw that even though we paid more for the beef on Holsteins compared to the Holsteins, it was worth it at the end because the premiums outweighed the discounts. And eventually we did see that we overpaid for them, which is one of the aims we had at that time. We calculated all these costs, like cost of gain, and all the output costs, everything we got on the carcass side, to see that we paid too much for them. And we did. We overpaid for them. They were worth more than the Holsteins based on everything we saw, but we overpaid for them. So we wanted to demonstrate there is a disconnect. Yes, they are worth more than Holsteins, but not that much more, as you can see. Overall, we just saw that compared to Holsteins, to beef on Holsteins, were better on the growth and the carcass side. We were able to show that they are worth more than the Holsteins, but the market did have a disconnect and they were overpricing them.
Were
Do you
they
think?
overpricing
Go ahead.
because they were comparing them to the straight beef steers or just paying too much?
We think that it was more so the popularity of them. People would see them and think, well, it's better than a Holstein, so it should definitely be worth more. But sometimes at that time, when this production system started, people were just breeding any beef semen to dairy cattle or dairy dams, and they were not being intentional about the selection criteria. So you were getting very different types of cattle, and many packers were not happy with that because you would get beef on dairy cattle that looked pretty much like a black Holstein. That's negative on the packer side because you're going to get a lot of discounts. It's basically sending a really big steer that doesn't really have much in terms of muscling. I think that's a part of it, that there was a big popularity, so they were being sold as very expensive compared to the Holsteins, but then we weren't getting what we should in terms of a beef type steer. It was more dairy type, but sometimes it would be more beef type. So that's why some people thought maybe we're overpaying for them because we don't know what we're getting. I think at that time, there were a lot of thoughts when it came to that. It was, you could get anything for what you were paying, if that makes sense. I think now with time, the beef on dairy cattle are more similar. They're the in between of dairy and beef. And I think prices have settled a little bit. It doesn't seem like the premiums are as high as they used to be. So I think that has changed with time. But at the time, I would say that it was more so the popularity of this production system, but we didn't really know how they would come out.
So, Melanie, have you worked with any economists to develop that premium kind of a little model, whether it's a spreadsheet model or an online, where you could say, this is what I anticipate the market price to be? Or I don't know if there's a good futures market. Where does a dairy beef fall compared to the futures market, which is looking at, I think, pure beef calves? But you could build that into your little model. Are you working with anybody? Because I think that'd be a really valuable tool. So what should I be paying for a week-old dairy beef cross, assuming it looks like a really good quality calf?
That's something that we are currently trying to work on. I don't have an answer right now on the future side, but that is something that we are trying to work on. So in that first study, that's something we tried to do in that paper that's it's published in the Journal of Applied Animal Science. We did different scenarios where we evaluated what the carcass prices of the beef on Holsteins would be if they were priced as dairy, beef on dairy, or beef cattle at the plant, like their base carcass price, because at that time we didn't know how the plant would price them. So in our case, when we went to JBS, which is who killed those cattle, they gave us an in-between price of the dairy discount and the beef basis. However, on our last study, this corn silage study, they gave us the beef-based carcass price because with time, the beef on dairy cattle are more like beef. So at the plant side, for the most part, you're going to be getting a beef-based carcass price. We're currently working on another study that we also took cattle to JBS, and that was the same thing. We also got the beef-based carcass price for the beef on Holsteins. So I think the market has kind of shifted towards accepting beef on dairy cattle as more beef type cattle, but I think it's because we have done work to improve them and they're more towards that. However, on the other part of your question, I don't have much on the future side, but that is something that we are currently trying to work on. We're trying to work on different economic tools that are focused on beef on dairy cattle because we have many for beef and dairy, but we don't have that. So maybe I'll have something for you on that later on.
A perfect, perfect student. Always more work to do.
Now, you mentioned that the generic beef on dairy steer, did you find differences between beef breeds that were used on the Holstein dams, Angus versus Charolais? What did you find?
So in our first study, we saw that the Bichon Holstein steers were sired by several different breeds. We had Angus, Limousin, Limousin Angus, Simmental. They were all over the board, and there were too many for us to be able to compare that. And we only got that sire data later on. So I don't have much to say in terms of statistical power. However, visually looking at that data, cattle sired by Angus bulls or Limousin bulls seem to have the greatest advantage compared to other ones in terms of marbling and muscling. But then for the other breeds, it was very similar. We didn't have enough head or power because we didn't get the sire breeds until later on. And that was the same with the corn silage study. We didn't get that data until later on. However, most of the cattle were sired by Angus bulls. So it was very uniform in terms of our population, the representation of sire breed. So again, I don't have data to show on that because they were almost all sired by Angus bulls.
You've referenced the corn silage or your second study. Let's kind of shift there. What was the big surprise when you got that data ground down?
There were so many things with that study. I think one of them was, so I don't remember who wrote this paper, but there is a paper that talks about liver abscesses seeming to be a more regional problem. And I think that's kind of what we saw in this study, that our Bichon Holsteins didn't really have a high incidence of liver abscesses, regardless of diet. We barely saw any liver abscesses in this corn silage study. On the Bichon Holstein side, we did have a higher percentage of liver abscesses for the Holstein steers. But I think that was one of the surprises, seeing that we didn't really see many liver abscesses on the Bichon Holsteins. But at the same time, it does track a little bit with that paper because they found that liver abscesses seem to be a bigger problem in areas like Texas, warmer areas where cattle genetics are also a little bit different compared to this area. So it made sense, but it was also a little bit surprising because we had seen a high liver abscess rate in our first study. So I was thinking it would be similar to that, but it was not. I don't remember the percentage, but I'm finding it right now because it was less than 15% and we had 60 head. So that was surprising for me because we were with this mindset that liver abscesses seem to be a problem in Bichon Holstein cattle, but that was not the case really for us compared to the Holsteins.
So why do you think that is? Because I
That's
think
okay.
that is a lot of there's a lot of what's going around. You hear that a lot. All these studies with these crosses or Holsteins have so many liver abscesses. Do you know whether it's your research or somebody else's? Is that true? If it's not true, or if some studies show there's lower liver abscesses like yours, why might that be the case? Because I think you do hear that's one of the reasons these dairy beef or these beef on dairy get discounted is because of the liver abscesses in addition to muscling and a few other things.
So we know that liver abscesses are predominantly because of diet. Diet has a really big factor to play in this, and we feed more fiber in this area compared to other areas. So even if we had different levels of fiber in our diets, I think the low fiber treatment, so steers that were getting fed 20% corn silage in their diet and more high moisture corn, I think they still had a higher percentage of fiber compared to other diets in other areas. There's also the fact that Texas and other regions are warmer, and those are things that predispose cattle to acidosis when combining that with the really hot diets, a lot of grain. I think we've seen that liver abscesses are multifactorial issue where diet plays a big role, but other things in the environment do so as well. And when you're in a warmer area and cattle get sicker as well, that all has a role to play. And I don't know if that's necessarily a part of what happened with our cattle, but we do have a very different climate. We have more fiber in the diet. Our cattle didn't really get sick throughout this study. We didn't see any morbidity. And sometimes when you see more sickness in cattle, that has some relationship with liver abscess development. It could have been anything, But I think fiber, climate, and health had a lot to do with it as well.
Kind of moving past the liver abscess you mentioned about health. If memory serves, the cost of medication was higher for crossbred calves in the study. What do you have any thoughts on why that was?
I'm looking at it now. So for that was the case in my first study because we did see more sickness in the beef on Holsteins in that first study. However, in this, in the corn silage study, it was higher for the Holsteins because we only really saw sickness in the Holsteins. We didn't see sickness in the beef on Holsteins. And when it came to other type of medication, it was also higher for the Holsteins. So that might have been the first study, because in the first one, we did see that the beef on Holsteins had, they got sick a few more times than the Holsteins.
I've got a question for you, a hypothetical situation. I'm looking at getting the best performance and minimizing liver abscesses and get paying the most and the most profit. Tell me how you'd feed straight Holsteins different than beef on, if there's a difference, than beef on dairy, than straight bred beef cattle. Should you feed them differently in order to get to maximize profit, maximize performance? Each of those kind of three categories: Holstein, beef on dairy, and then straight bred beef.
I think I would treat Holsteins and beef on Holsteins a little bit more similarly. They definitely need more fiber in their diets, and that's predominantly because of the way that they are raised as calves compared to beef. I think that rumen environment needs more stimulation so that they can have more buffering, and that can decrease some of the acidosis issues compared with beef. I'm not saying that beef doesn't need fiber or may not suffer from the same problems, but I think that the way that they are raised as calves definitely sets them up differently. And that's why we see less of these issues in beef cattle. So I think beef on Holsteins and Holsteins should be fed more similarly, more fiber in their diet. They already have a longer amount of days on feed, so this may set them off a little bit in terms of days on feed and cost of gain compared to beef, but I think that's one of the ways that you can get the best outcome in terms of performance, health, and when I say health, I mean rumen health and gastrointestinal health compared to cattle that beef on Holstein and Holstein cattle that are not getting as much fiber in their diet.
When you were in these feeding trials, what was your implant strategies for the different classes of steers?
In this last study, they all got the same implants. So we started with Synovix Choice and then followed that with a Synovix One feedlot. So that's the one that's an extended release. It's basically two implants in one. So it's kind of like giving them three implants. They are on feed for a longer time than beef cattle. We are currently working on a study where we had beef on Holsteins, Holsteins, and beef. In that study, for example, it was a little bit different. So Holsteins and beef on Holsteins got Synovix Choice and Synovix One feedlot. However, beef cattle, because we knew they would be on feed for a shorter amount of time, they only got Synovix Choice because they went to the plant earlier. We didn't want that really long time implant. We didn't want something that would affect them negatively in terms of marbling because it would still be phasing out by the time they went to the plant. We also wanted some payout on that. In this current study, that's what we did, but in that study, we treated them similarly. I have read in some papers that it may be beneficial to implant them with something that's more estrogenic, but we have not done that. However, I think that would be something interesting to look at because I think that might be a way to get more out of an implant when it comes to dairy type cattle.
On these crossbreds, is that timing uber important? I mean, that second shot is how critical is that?
I think it's important because the crosses, they still have dairy genetics in them. So we want to make sure that we add more muscling to them. And the beef genetics certainly help, but these implants can help us drive that muscle deposition. So I think it's really important to get the most out of an implant. And that's why we really like the Synovix One feedlot option, because that way Now, with all these regulations, it's really tricky to get a third implant in. So that's the best way to have a third implant somehow without doing so. But I think it's really important when it comes to muscling.
What day are you looking at that your data says, day 200, day 150? What day is that you would recommend from your data?
For the second implant,
Second implant.
yeah. So we put in the first implant around day 28 on trial. And I believe the second implant went in around day 84, I think. I don't remember that very well. But that way, I think the first portion pays out around 100 to 120 days. So then the second portion would start a few days after that. But I think it was around day 84. But the tricky thing about these things is that when we get cattle on trial for a study, you don't know necessarily how old they are when they come in. We usually implant them as fast as we can when we start this study, but maybe in one study they were averaging around 400 pounds. The next one they could be around 600 pounds. So it all depends. I think when we talk about days on feed and study, it's somewhat tricky because that can differ by study. That makes sense. But we do try to give the second implant as soon as we can so that there's not a lag in between implants. We try to not let a lot of space go in between implants.
So, Melanie, you had mentioned earlier when you were doing the study that you anticipated or you knew the straight beef classes were going to not be on feed as many days. Was that because you knew they'd grow faster, or did you slaughter them at a lighter weight? I mean, it had to be one or the other if they came in at the same weight. So, why was that?
They came in at a heavier weight. The way that we harvest cattle is on an empty body fat basis because we think that that's the best way to compare them at a similar body composition. Usually, they also reach that empty body fat that we target, which is around 31% earlier or faster than dairy type cattle. It takes them a shorter amount of time to put up a percent of empty body fat. Did come in at a heavier weight than
Okay.
our crosses in dairy.
Melanie, we've kind of ran you up and down the waterfront in our discussion today. It was very interesting. If you're going to give feedlot operator one thing to think about with his next group of beef on dairy genetic animals, what would that be?
I think the most important thing, and I think I said this at one point, is that you really have to be, if you are able to do so, if you're able to breed the cattle yourself, I think the most important thing is being intentional. Because if this, I keep referencing the third study that you don't have that data, still working on it. This third study that we're working on, we selected sires to breed to dairy dams ourselves. And they were Simmental Angus bulls. The reason why we did that was because we wanted to have the best of both worlds in terms of muscling and marbling. And we chose sires that had really good marbling potential. And I think if you're able to do the breeding yourself, to do the selection yourself, and you're very intentional about it, you can get really good beef on dairy crosses. However, I know that's not always the case. I think another thing is just keeping in mind that these cattle are usually a bit more expensive than Holsteins, but if you're good about formulating good rations that are going to get you the best in performance and health, you can get cattle that will outweigh that cost when it comes to the product. I don't know if that makes sense. I think for me, the most important thing is really being really intentional about selection criteria. I think if we're very intentional about the beef on dairy cattle that we're putting out there, we're going to get a good product. It's going to be better than the Holstein product because I think beef on Holsteins are really a way to improve the existing Holstein calf so that the dairy producer can get more and then the beef producer can get more. The plant can also get more. It's not really substituting beef, it's just a better version of the Holstein calf.
When do you anticipate data from this third study?
So we just finished harvesting and getting data out of the beef steers. We only have the Holstein steers left. So hopefully by next year. And actually, we'll have some data to present this year at the Discover Beef and Dairy Conference, now that I'm thinking about it. So we are going to be presenting some of that data. Dr. Jaworek is taking the lead and talking about all the FAB data that we're getting. So we're actually taking some of these cattle to the MSU meat lab, and we are harvesting them ourselves. We're also getting carcass cutout data so that we can see how much the actual yield of these cattle are. So he's going to be presenting that data at the Discover Beef and Dairy Conference. So there will be some data there, but then the rest, hopefully by spring, I'll have something to discuss.
Jim, it sounds like we may have to invite Melanie back to the Beef on Dairy Conference next year.
Yeah, it sounds like you're a really good PhD student. Sounds like you're doing a lot of interesting work. Just remember, as a student, you'll be the smartest you'll ever be in your life. Once you get like Fred and I, there's just no room left in your brain, or I don't know, you forget it because you lose some brain cells or something. But congratulations, that's a big accomplishment, and sounds like you're doing well and really good research.
Thank
Well,
you. Thank you.
on those note, today we were visiting with Melanie Concepcion, PhD student at Michigan State University, working with Dan Buskirk. We're excited about the information she presented and looking forward to this third study. We will be expecting great things from you, Melanie.
Thank you, and thank you for having me today.
Very good. Thank you, the people who are attending our podcast. We appreciate you supporting us and looking forward to having you with us next month.
Thank our annual sponsors, including our gold sponsor, Iowa Corn Growers Association. Please visit their website at iowacorn.org. We'd also like to thank our silver sponsors, Pioneer, Connor Agri Service, Diamond V, and Central Vet Clinic. I-29 Moo University is an equal opportunity educator. For the full discrimination statement, visit extension.iastate.edu/diversity/ext.